Now, BBC Radio 4, Stuart McConey explores the partnership behind Peter Cook and Dudley Moore in this week's Double Trouble with a bit of a chat.
Is that you, Roger?
Yes, Father.
Now, I don't know, Roger, if you know anything about the method whereby you came to be brought about.
Well, sir, some of the boys at school say very filthy things about it, sir.
This is what I was worried about, and this is why I thought I'd have a bit of a chat and explain absolutely frankly and openly the method whereby you and everybody in this world came to be. In particular, it was necessary for your mother. It was necessary for your mother to sit on a chair. To sit on a chair which I had recently vacated and which was still warm from my body. And then something very mysterious, rather wonderful and beautiful happened. And sure enough, 4 years later, you were born. Now, there's nothing unhealthy about this, Roger. There's nothing unnatural. It's a beautiful thing in the right hands, and there's no need to think less of your mother because of it. She had to do it, she did it, and here you are.
Well, sir, it's very kind of you to tell me. One thing actually slightly alarms me. I was sitting in this very chair yesterday, sir, and I vacated it, and the cat sat on it while it was still warm.
Like the Beatles, Shakespeare, and a good Chateau Rothschild 1962, the reputation of Peter Cook and Dudley Moore is not only undimmed, but seems to grow as the years go by. They were, without doubt, and with due respect to their contemporaries, the most original and inspirational comedy double act of the 60s and 70s. Cook was born in 1937. His father was a civil servant in the diplomatic service, and Peter fully expected to grow up to become a diplomat himself. He was schooled at Radley College and then Cambridge, a very pucker upbringing in the traditional rather than Jamie Oliver sense. A social world away, Dudley Moore grew up on a council housing estate in Dagenham. Though their home lives were very different, school for both of them was a bore and a trauma. Later, some of their greatest work together was often born of improvisation. So listen to them here, free-forming wildly to cover the tedium of being asked for the umpteenth time about bullying, even by gorgeous, craggy Michael Parkinson.
Yes, I was bullied very severely. I was given up for dead. They brought all the specialists in, and I was buried, in fact. I suffered very, 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 very badly at school, Michael, and I'm sorry you brought it up.
Oh, I have terrible fantasies of my worst enemies. I still, you know, like impaling them on railings and reaching down into their mouths and pulling out their spleens and tying it round their neck and then pulling out the eyes, perhaps, one by one. I have super times thinking about all that sort of thing.
No, I love everybody. Yeah. The world is my kingdom, and the world loves me, and yeah. I love the world. I don't have an enemy in the world.
You have an enemy around again, though, don't you?
I have to have that, because of...
He's his own worst enemy, you know.
Humour, and joking their way out of danger or adversity, was part of the adolescent armoury of Cook and Moore, as they are never known. The mythic E.L. Whistey was the product of such situations.
I imitated masters, and there was one... There was one man there who waited at the high table. It was called Mr. Boylett, and he was quite a curious man. And he'd come up with odd sentences, and I think I'm quoting him right. He'd say, "I saw a very interesting stone today." And I'd say, "Oh, yes, why do you say it?" He said, "Just down by the driveway, I saw it. And I thought I saw it move." So I said, "Oh, yes." And he said, "It's probably worth something, that stone. If they move, they must be valuable." I had long conversations with him about moving stones and twigs he'd seen which had hovered in a strange way and might be valuable. So I was going around Radley sort of doing Boylettisms a lot. Became a sort of voice caught on. I thought I saw it move. It became a catchphrase for anything.
We've been looking down at what's going to happen tonight. We've seen it several times. We're very sorry about Mr. Prendergast and the number 9 bus. I know he's out there listening, and I know he thinks that by knowing about it in advance, he can avoid it. But it's no good, Mr. Prendergast. You could sit in the theatre all night. It would still get you. Personally, I think it would be more sensible to pop out and be run down in the street. At least there's some logic to that. But if you want a bus to come careering in through the theatre, that's up to you. That's what freedom of choice is all about.
Peter studied French and German at Cambridge, but of course the real purpose of being there, as it was for legions of stage-struck public schoolboys, was to join the Cambridge Amateur Dramatic Society and the famous Footlights Review. It was whilst at Cambridge that he also wrote for a West End review called Pieces of Eight, performed by, amongst others, Kenneth Williams and Fenella Fielding. John Cleese remembers that Peter's influence at Cambridge was still palpable after he'd gone down, or come up, or whatever it is they do.
Well, I arrived there, I think, a year after Peter Cook had left, and his influence was incredibly strong. Everybody was doing old Peter Cook sketches. I remember Trevor Nunn sitting down and doing Interesting Facts, one of my favourite sketches, for me, and everybody was talking in that kind of voice, and all the sketches were done on park benches. And even when it wasn't immediately obvious, somebody like David Frost had a couple of solos in the Footlights show that year, and you could see that they were terribly influenced by Cookie. And I think it was a very, very prolonged influence. It's almost a subterranean one. It wasn't, the time I got there, it wasn't that conscious, but it was just there. And I still think that he's the most original, most funny man that this whole wave has produced.
While Cambridge was under the influence of Cook, Dudley Moore was under the influence of Bach and Bartok at Oxford.
I got this MacKinnon Organ Scholarship to Magdalen College, Oxford, and it is... There's no doubt that Oxford is a beautiful town. I didn't quite know what I was doing amongst all this gorgeousness, but it certainly was a very useful time. And I remember in my third year I started getting interested in doing cabaret and that sort of thing, and I was seduced by the sound of an audience laughing, that sort of stuff. You know, I thought, oh, this is good. I can do this again, maybe, tomorrow night. And I think that's when the rots really set in, and I stayed on an extra year really to cash in, I suppose, on that sort of initial interest that had seemed to come my way.
Dudley and Alan were at Oxford and vaguely knew each other. Jonathan had left Cambridge before I arrived, and somebody called John Bassett knew of us all and asked us to do an hour's show at the Edinburgh Festival. And we all met and did this hour show. We all had our own little bits of our own and wrote some stuff together. And it was a complete accident. And there suddenly we were doing Beyond the Fringe in the West End, then going off to Broadway, and it was pure accident.
It was so nice to have something regular to do and something for which you were paid and, you know, and gave you a certain amount of notoriety, perhaps, or celebrity. It was a very nice show to do. It was great fun. I mainly contributed the musical part of it, you know, but it was a wonderful experience for me anyway.
We of the four in Beyond the Fringe were the two who really enjoyed doing it. Jonathan was agonizing a little bit about whether he should be a doctor. Alan at the time was wondering whether he should be a history don at Oxford. And Dudley and I just couldn't believe our luck. We were enjoying ourselves so much.
How will it be, this end of which you have spoken, Brother M.M.?
How will it be?
Well, it will be as 'twere a mighty rending in the sky, you see. And the mountain shall sink, you see, and the valley shall rise, you see, and great shall be the tumult thereof.
Will the veil of the temple be rent in twain?
The veil of the temple will be rent in twain. About 2 minutes before, we see the sign of the manifest flying beast head in the sky head.
Oh. And will there be a mighty wind, Brother Ennis?
Certainly there'll be a mighty wind, if the word of God is anything to go by.
And And will this wind be so mighty as to lay low the mountains of the earth?
No, it will not be quite as mighty as that. That is why we've come up on the mountain, see, you stupid nit, to be safe.
I think that, to be fair, Peter Cook wrote a very large proportion of things. He certainly wrote some of the funniest and strangest jokes in it all.
Polymath and all-round Renaissance man, Jonathan Miller.
He was a sort of, I think, of the four of us, the most spectacular sort of comic genius, I think. There's something so odd and peculiar about his imagination. If you were sitting down at table with him, not with a view to writing a sketch or a scene or anything, he could go into routines which would keep you convulsed with laughter for something like 2 hours. In the end, it became exhausting because there was no way of competing with it or getting in on the act at all, or standing up to it. It was like a seizure. It overtook him. He very often spoke in one or other of his famous funny voices, either the E.L. Wistie type or very upper-class voices that he had. And he had a number of these voices which took control of him. And it was almost like what we call glossolalia, people speaking in tongues. And when he was in one of these, what I can only describe as comic spasms, there was no stopping him. He was unbelievably inventive in ways which I think none of us had ever seen or heard before. It was a type of comic imagination with no equivalent or parallel that I could imagine.
Now, Mr. Spigot, you are auditioning, are you not, for the part of Tarzan?
Right.
Now, Mr. Spigot, I couldn't help noticing almost at once that you are a one-legged person.
You noticed that?
When you've been in the business as long as I have, Mr. Spigot, you get to notice these little things almost instinctively. Now, Mr. Spigot, you, a one-legged man, are applying for the role of Tarzan.
Right.
A role that traditionally involves the use of a two-legged actor.
True.
And yet you, a unidexter, are applying for the role.
Definitely.
A role for which two legs would seem to be the minimum requirement.
In spite of this comic self-possession and an evident genius on stage, Cook, at this point, didn't believe that he'd continue as a performer. He saw himself as a writer.
Your right leg, I like your right leg. It's a lovely leg for the role. That's what I said when I saw it come in. I said, lovely leg for the role. Lovely leg for the role. I've got nothing against your right leg. The trouble is, neither of you.
Cook's first success was as comic entrepreneur. In 1961, he realised a university dream with the setting up of the Establishment Club, a home for sophisticated comedy in the West End. Boasting a pre-opening membership of some 7,000, and being a private club and thus safe from the blue pencil remit of the Lord Chamberlain's office, it became a huge success. Such luminaries as John Bird, Frankie Howard and Lenny Bruce performed there. Dudley was persuaded to play jazz in the basement, persuaded with some ease since it offered further opportunity to meet gorgeous young women. The meteoric growth of radio and television was having a profound effect on the nature of stage humour. No longer could you work for 7 years with the same show, as many a pratfalling vaudevillian was finding to his cost. Humour had to be more immediate, more up-to-date and more specifically targeted, as people were generally more aware. They called it satire, wrongly, according to John Cleese.
Humour did not appear to me to be satirical. It seemed to me the areas that one ought to be operating in. Then what happened was that the press got hold of it and stamped it satire and said this is political and significant. And all the people in London, without a sense of humour, were able to accept it and take it as being very important because it had a social meaning.
I think the combination of Beyond the Fringe and the Establishment had a substantial impact I don't think that was the week would have ever happened without Beyond the Fringe and the Establishment. I suppose it wasn't a sort of deliberate thing on our part that we would open up things. It's just things opened up. I mean, the fact that satire was then fashionable made it more likely that that was the week it would be put on. Good though many things were in it, by its very nature could never be as outrageous again as stuff done at the Establishment.
Meanwhile, by sitting in a recently vacated warm chair perhaps, Beyond the Fringe and the Establishment Club begat not only but also the first real pairing of Cook and Moore. After performing with Beyond the Fringe in New York, Pete and Dudley began to improvise together. Alan Bennett later recalled, they sparked each other off, and they knew it too, because even then they were talking about doing things together. A clearly combustible combination, it wasn't long before this double act really took off. Bill Cotton, former head of light entertainment at the BBC.
Well, it nearly happened by mistake. We'd booked Dudley to do a special for BBC Two, and he immediately asked if he could have Peter Cook as a guest on the show. It ended up with Peter being in 95% of it. Everything, indeed, except the piano playing. So we changed the title to Not Only Dudley Moore, but also Peter Cook. Not Only, but Also for short. Their Pete and Dud sketches were really mind-blowing, especially when Pete got Dud to the point where he was helpless with laughter, and that was what he was always aiming to do.
Actually, those two characters were our favourite characters, Pete and Dud, or Dud and Pete, whoever got top billing that week. And they started off as two characters in a pub. We just did this story where they were talking about the trouble they had with all these...
Women,
you know. The other night, I come home from work, I was feeling very tuckered out, you know.
Of course you were.
Yeah, of course I was. Very tuckered out. And made myself a cup of hot chocolate, you know.
Yeah,
very nice. And I'm going up the stairs. As I'm going up the stairs, I smell this funny smell. I thought, funny. you know, maybe I left the gas on. So I went upstairs,
still with the chocolate.
We're still with the hot chocolate.
Yeah.
I had such a tremendous time with Dudley, doing Not Only but Also on the BBC. And really scarcely seemed to be a job. Everything was very loose and relaxed, and we could do whatever we wanted. We weren't particularly outrageous or anything, but I just loved doing it, and he was a perfect comedy partner for me, and vice versa, I think.
Man has, in his infinite understanding, made a lot of wonderful things, wonderful inventions for ladies over the years.
Oh, man!
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, he's been prolific. Yeah.
What? Who was it who invented the brassiere?
Oh, the brassiere.
A man.
A man, right.
A man, Dr. Otto Tixley. Well-known Viennese philosopher suddenly said, "Eureka! The bra!"
Right,
and there it was.
There
for
they
them.
Were, and of course, one must not forget the paper panty.
Who could forget the paper panty?
Who could forget the paper panty? Because in the old days, when you know, ladies used to have to scrub for hours their drawers over a hot stove, you know, soap and water and a hard brush. Brushing their drawers for hours and hours.
Hours and hours.
Whereas now, thanks to the paper panty,
yeah.
All she has to do of an evening is go over them with a rubber.
Pete and Dud, riffing like Goodens from a 1986 series featuring Joan Rivers in her own chat show with Peter as co-host and showing how the old magic was never far from the surface. The magisterial Peter Cook, suave, elegant, phenomenally gifted, clearly seemed the senior partner of the duo. But as Jonathan Miller, their old accomplice, emphasises, Dudley Moore, the twinkling, genial foil, was essential to their success.
Well, Dudley was very adept at assuming one of the characters who was ventriloquially managed by Peter. I mean, it somehow diminishes Dudley's contribution, and I don't mean to do that. I think that there are very, very few, if any, other people who could have worked in the way that Dudley did with Peter so successfully. There was no one except Dudley who could have worked so inventively with him and resonated. The thing about Dudley is he is, or certainly was, a wonderful actor. He was the ideal partner for Peter. And he was not just a straight man. He was a very comic man who didn't have the verbal inventiveness that, or just simply the comic inventiveness that Peter had. But he could certainly react to it extremely successfully.
They are of themselves complete entities. Dudley Moore stands on his own, Peter Cook stands on his own, and the sum becomes greater than the parts when they get together. Broadcaster and collector of Comedy Archive, Fred Housego.
Remember, double act is about response. If the person with you doesn't respond, there's no double act. It's just a one-man audience. When you think of Pete and Doug when they're in the art gallery and he says, have you noticed how they always follow you round the room? All the way through, Dudley Moore has to be there. He has to be patient. He has to wait for his little moment to come in. He then goes off on his own little sort of flight of fantasy, and what you have is the sum of the parts is the greater. It's a unique piece of comedy.
Another thing we've wasted money on is that bloody Suzanne, Grande Baigneuse. Yeah. Have you seen that load of rubbish?
No.
It's over there.
Oh, yeah.
There it is, those fat nude ladies with their bottoms towards you.
Yeah.
That's Les Grande Baigneuse. You know what it means, don't you?
What's it?
Big bathers.
Is that all?
That's all it means, yeah. Big bathers. 500,000 quid we pay for that. Those nude women come out of our pocket, Dad.
Yeah. Works out about £50,000 a body, doesn't it?
Well, you could get the real nude ladies over there for that price.
Yeah. My Aunt Dolly would have done it for nothing.
Pete and Dud were often risque and frequently bizarre, but there was little that would have had your granny spluttering into her Saturday night cocoa. This, though, could never be said for their two most notorious and lurid creations, the foul-mouthed Derek and Clive. Jonathan Miller.
I don't know how these things originated. I think what would happen, there would be sort of drunken evenings in which they'd sit down at a tape recorder and start inventing. I mean, what is so wonderful about them is it's a marvellous way of using obscenity to produce cleanliness. The repetitive use of foul four-letter words again and again and again, after a while it makes you realise that they are, after all, nothing but words. But it was the repetitive use of these now still forbidden four-letter words that made you realise, well, there's nothing obscene about them at all. They're referring to parts of our bodies which we use every day.
I'll tell you what the Conservative Party should do in the next general election.
Yeah, go on.
I'll tell you what would really get the electorate going if is that that Maggie Thatcher just flashed it.
And there we must leave Derek and Clive, because sadly that is the only broadcastable section we could find.
Derek and Clive are Dudley and myself, as we often used to be backstage with nobody listening. We made the first record entirely to amuse ourselves, had no idea, had no intention of releasing it commercially. And then these pirate tapes got out and got, especially with rock bands, we carry them around, they'd have bits of Derek and Clive, they'd have bits of Harold Wilson losing his temper with David Dimbleby, and all sorts of funny, what one would think to be outtakes. And Chris Blackwell of Ireland said, well, look, all these people are hearing it in any case, why not put it out on record? So we did.
Derek and Clive were born in boozy backstage repartee. Dudley Moore was later to find global fame as the inebriated millionaire Arthur. But by the late 1970s, Peter's drinking had gone beyond a joke and was taking its toll on their personal and professional partnership. Here's the aforementioned David Dimbleby not angering Harold Wilson, but getting behind the mask of the funny man and the funny voices in a 1979 interview with Peter Cook that is one of his most revealing.
And we were very well entertained in Australia. And I tended to have too much to drink before the show, and we reached an agreement that I wouldn't have a drink before the show. And on the whole, I kept to it.
When was it spoiling your performances?
No, it was spoiling the performance for Dudley, in that I would wing off in various directions. It wasn't sort of noticeable to an audience, but I'd take off and ad lib all over the place. Very annoying for him.
Did it disturb you or worry you?
It disturbed me that it angered Dudley and caused difficulties there. Happened a bit in the States as well. used to get very, very cross with me about that.
He did?
Yes, rightly so.
Why?
What with me winging off totally away from the sketch and having a very good time myself and him not. Extremely annoying.
The Australian tour had been with a review called, this time, Behind the Fridge. In 1972, the show was brought back to London. But the opening night was the beginning of the end for Pete and Dud. Peter was hopelessly drunk, and Dudley decided he could tolerate it no more. In 1975, after they'd toured with the review in America, renamed Good Evening, Dudley stayed on in the States. But gentleman that he is, Dudley Moore was too courteous to ever kiss and tell.
I'm going to ask both of you this, independently. What was the nicest thing about him? What was the worst thing about him? Let's just go for the worst.
This is like a golfer, you know. Yes. He knows, just as you're going to do your stroke, he lights his cigarette. The nicest thing about him was that he was very jolly and very, very full of humour. I like that. He seemed to be very unflappable and drifted on over the years through some of the minor maelstroms that the four of us hit. The nastiest thing about him... Oh, blimey.
Just spit it out.
I can't think what was the nastiest thing. When we met, I wasn't aware of it. He was an angel. I can't think, actually. We didn't really know each other well enough to know the nasty things, but they... And in fact, we went on to enjoy each other's performances so much that we became a team. So there wasn't a nasty side to it, really.
What about you? What was the nicest thing about him and the least nicest?
The nicest thing about Dudley at the time, and it remains today, is his ability to lie through his teeth smiling.
Now is the time to say goodbye. Goodbye. Now is the time to yield a sigh.
Yield it, yield it.
Now is the time to wend our way until we meet again some sunny day.
And so, it's goodbye to a double act of rare talent and idiosyncratic brilliance. Though they had effectively ceased working together several years earlier, the partnership was irrevocably broken on Peter Cook's sad and premature death in January 1995. But Pete and Dud, Derek and Clive, E.L. Whistie, Mr. Spigot and the rest are assured of their place among the greats of British comedy.
Goodbye. Goodbye. Why not say it again? Goodbye.
Goodbye.
We
Double Trouble is presented by Stuart McConey and produced in Manchester by Angela Sherwin. The series producer is Libby Cross, and the final programme next week looks at the two Ronnies.